and which I hope will be of interest to you. And I want to catch that flavour mainly through images, not through theories. On a morning rather like today, some years ago, on the Feast of the Ascension, when I was in my college in England as headmaster, and I thought I had finished my obligations for the day, and it was a beautiful summer day. You don't have the advantage of knowing the game of cricket, but the game of cricket goes with the English summer, and you hear it in the distance, a gentle sound of bat on ball, very little crowd participation. And on this lovely day, I went into my study, and I was looking out of the window at our lovely valley, rather like here, and my thought was, this world is quite beautiful enough for me. I'm not really particularly interested at this moment in eternity. And suddenly, I remembered something I'd forgotten, which was that I was due that very evening to go to our local city, York, in order to preach on the Ascension. And my heart sank. I had no desire at all to preach on the Feast of the Ascension. I felt, as it were, at that moment, a really happy pagan. And I did what we sometimes do when we're short of inspiration. I wandered over to the side of the room and I turned on the television. And then I wandered on a bit further and I turned on the radio, just to distract myself for some minutes and hope for some inspiration. And a very strange and beautiful thing happened. The television was on, but with the sound turned down, and the radio was on with the sound turned up. And on the television, I saw what we call Formula One Grand Prix racing, you know, in Indianapolis and all that, but the European version of it. And there was the Monaco, the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. And these beautiful cars, red, yellow, blue, green, flashing round this circuit, and a beautiful place with the Mediterranean in the background. A lovely sight, but the sound turned down, so I couldn't hear the, you know, the equivalent of the fans and things, and this tremendous motor noise. And on the other side, from the radio, there was coming the great central choruses from Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. Et incarnatus est, et crucifixus est, et resurrexit, et ascendit. And transfixed, I watched the beautiful images of the Monte Carlo Grand Prix, all the lovely coloured things of this world flashing by, a kind of celebration of movement and colour. And on the other side, to the accompaniment of this music, which was quietly and nobly going through the great moments in the redemption brought about by Christ, his becoming man, his entering into this world of the Monte Carlo Grand Prix and making it his own, and then the process by which he returned to his Father, lifting the Monte Carlo Grand Prix with him. Because otherwise, the whole process doesn't really make sense for us if he just came, visited us for a little time, and then went back again. And so, as I watched the motor cars going round the track, I thought very strongly, here is our own beautiful world, which Jesus Christ has come to share and then to take with him back to the Father. It was very useful, because after that I didn't really have to prepare a special homily, because it was given me on a plate. So that's one image which I'd like to start the week with. The world is, for me that day, it was that motor race. For each of you, there will be other things that quite often give you the feeling, and give your children the feeling, and your children's friends the feeling, that this world is quite enough. We can get along quite nicely without a whole lot of special teaching about another invisible world that we can't see. So we start our reflections in this beautiful world that we can see as we walk around Mount Angel today. The second image, which was the one I mentioned when I wrote to Mimi, and which Jeremy will have picked up when we were talking in Rome, happened like this. I noticed that there's just been a meeting of the oblates of Mount Angel here over this previous 2 or 3 days. I am master of oblates now in our monastery, and I was invited to go to attend a meeting of oblate masters in France. And it was in a very great and famous old monastery, one of the oldest centers of monastic life in the world, in a place called Ligugey, just outside Poitiers, and was a monastery founded before the time of St. Benedict, a monastery founded by St. Martin of Tours in France. And I was very happy to go there for the first time. And on the Sunday morning, I walked down from the monastery, through the monastery garden, along a pathway which reached a gate and led into a little lane that ran down a little valley to a river. And this was La Belle France, beautiful France, a lovely ancient place with woods and nightingales singing in the trees and sheep and cattle in ancient fields with ancient hedges and an even more ancient, lovely little river running down, with a lane leading up to the monastery. And as I looked back up the lane into the garden, I could hear, Sunday morning about 10 o'clock, I could hear somebody playing the Abbey organ, a Bach toccata in the distance, and then the church spire and the people getting ready to celebrate the Sunday Eucharist. And the whole thing felt like an offertory. Starting where I was standing, down by the river, here was the riches of nature, the fruits of the earth, being drawn quietly up that path to become work of human hands, offered on the altar, a lovely movement from the heart of nature to the heart of God. Fine. But there was another element which was totally different. In the 1890s, when the monks were exiled from France, the French built the main railway line from Paris to Bordeaux, right across the monastery garden. So that between me and the abbey was this viaduct across the garden, and along it, as I was watching, there ran what they call the TGV, Le Train de Grande Vitesse. It's a very fast train, goes about 300 kilometers an hour. And there it was, it flashed by from north to south, and I saw startled faces as they looked out for a moment and saw the monastery, and then were whisked away down towards the Mediterranean. And a few minutes later, a goods train carrying lots of crates of goodies trundled across, going from one city to another. And at first I thought, how sad, what a pity that the quiet, the peace, the beauty of this very ancient monastic site should be invaded and spoiled, as it were, by this great lumbering modern technology with its noise and its aggressiveness and its confusion. How incongruous that the monastery should have to have this in its garden. But as I thought and stood there, and another one flashed back, the whole picture began to assume a different shape. It wasn't a lovely movement from nature to God. broken up by an unlovely, modern thing, it gradually took on the form of a cross, in which the upright of the cross was what I've been describing, this relationship between nature, water, cultivation, growth, beauty, art, the making of the bread, the playing of the organ, the making of the wine, the Eucharist. That was the upright. And right across it, held at the heart of the upright, there was this horizontal beam, which was the beam of our world. And there in that train, there was, after all, maybe very in a very transient and short-lived way, there was a community in that train, a community of people, families, business people, sharing for a time the mystery of human existence and going from one city to another, seeking to do good in all sorts of ways, some seeking pleasure, some supporting their families, the other train carrying the products of one human city to another human city. Here was the ordinary commerce of human life, the human life that we all know so well in one way or another, the life of the human city. And it's a life which is, by its very nature, horizontal. You can't stop in the street when you're on the way to the office to say your prayers. You may have prayer in your heart, but the human city has the right to be and is by its nature horizontal. It flows between one human city and another human city. And yet, there it is, crossing the upright in the monastery garden, and for a brief moment, being held in the position of the horizontal beam of the cross. And it occurred to me, as I was watching this scene, that this really represented both the needs of the horizontal beam and the mission of the upright, and that the heart of the Christian life, and the heart in a particular way of the monastic life, takes place in the joint between the upright and the horizontal. That it's in the joint that the pressure between the upright movement, which has brought you all here during these few days, this search to express and to celebrate and to spread this sense of our upright movement towards God and His availability down the upright. And on the other hand, you bring with you what you are, your families, your children, your concerns, your work, your problems, anxieties, failures, your awareness of a world out there which often has no sense at all of the need for or the presence of any upright. And you'll bring those two things together, and all the pressures of the horizontal and the upright are concentrated in this point. And as we know, anybody who does any carpentry or woodwork knows that if you're making a joint of that kind between two beams at right angles to each other, it has to be done well. You have to make space in the upright so that the horizontal can be carried. You have to make space in the horizontal so that the two can meet and meld and become one. And this, in a way, is my theme for these few days, that the upright and the horizontal are at right angles to each other, and therefore there is a tension. Our attraction to this world, our involvement in this world, is an involvement which is by its nature horizontal. And in a way, God is not present in it. The God of the other world God is not in it. But the whole mystery, what we celebrate in Christianity, is that he is. And that at the heart of the joint, there is the mystery of the incarnation of Christ, the death of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, the ascension of Christ, the coming of the Spirit. It all takes part in the joint of the upright. Now, going from there to the wider implications of the image, a question. What does God think about this world of his, which is created? What does God think about the Monte Carlo Grand Prix? What does God think about the technology which makes our world what it is? The technology of transport, the technology of communication. What does God think about the internet and of surfing the email? Is he into this? These are some of the questions. See, there's some of the questions that I want to explore in a sort of theological but practical way as we go along. But first, let's look for a moment at the book of Genesis, which describes to us poetically what God is up to, what he's about in the act of creation. And the main fact, the main perception I want to communicate is that God very deliberately creates the world with its horizontal implications and its horizontal needs. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. By the way, they had no word for what we call the world at that time. The phrase the heavens and the earth is the nearest they get to expressing that. Let there be light, and there was light. And God saw how good the light was, and he separated the light from the darkness. Now, in these opening phrases of Genesis, there's a great deal of separation going on. He separates the light from the darkness. He separates the waters above the heavens from the waters under the heavens. He separates the dry land and the waters. And then, having separated things, he celebrates the separation by making things profoundly and completely different from each other. The one thing we really notice in the opening chapter of Genesis is that God makes things different. And he's doing the whole thing. And here is the mystery, here's the question, the why. When God makes things in his own image, why does he invent difference? And why does he invent multiplicity? He wants there, quite clearly, he wants there to be as many as possible of each thing. He tells them to increase and multiply. And finally, he produces that wonderful difference, and it's a profoundly horizontal difference, the creation of man and woman. This is in response to, in the second account of creation, when God says it is not good for man to be alone. And in the first account, he says, the writer says, and so God made man in his own image. In his own image, he made him. Man is like God, an echo of God. And then, as if that's not quite enough, in his own image he made him, male and female, he made them. There's a jump in the syntax from singular to plural, which is never explained, but what that does at once is say that in the world as made by God, there is now an essential horizontal dimension between one reality and the other reality. What God has done in creating is to express in creation the presence of the other and to invent an attraction between one and the other. And the whole of his creation consists of this horizontal electric charge, if you like, and the scientific facts confirm it, that at every level in creation, from the macro with its great forces to the micro with its enormously complex systems of attraction, the existence of everything is a celebration of a relationship with the other. And right from the outset, in the book of Genesis, we see the world as having its own horizontal character. It consists of this network, complex, of vital charges running between the, at every level, between the different realities of nature, but celebrated above all by the writer of Genesis on the last day of creation, by the creation of man and woman. We'll come back to that. The point I really wanted to make here and now is that in the world as God made it, there is a very great mystery of separation. We live in the world of time and space, and we are by that very fact bound to be separated, separated from other moments. The moment at which I said this world, this word, has now gone forever. It can be recaptured briefly on tape, but that's not the same. This is one of the mysteries of music. Music, by its very nature, is an extraordinary attempt to express the reality of eternity in the dimension of time. Because it hardly puts its foot into the dimension of time. As soon as you sing the note or play the note, it's finished. You can write down a score, and that helps you to recapture the music. But music, by its nature, is gone. It's like water flowing in a river. You can't go to the same river twice. It's never the same. And music is an extraordinary kind of mysterious bridge between God's eternity and our time. But living in time and space is living surrounded by separations, and therefore by a whole load of movements. The train crossing the monastery garden from Paris to Bordeaux is expressing perfectly the reality of a world which depends on separation and on movement between one point and another point. And in all our lives, as we speak our words, the existence of language is a way of building bridges between one point and another point, between one person and another person, between one generation and another generation. We live in a world of separations. The world we live in is by its nature horizontal. Why? In the first place, why did God do this? We can spend the whole of our lives seeking for that answer. We have the scriptures to help us. Why did God do this? Why did God make a world which was so different from the life in God, and which became a very ambiguous world? God so loved the world, says St. John, that he sent his only Son. But the very same St. John says very different things. If the world hates you, realize that it hated me first. If you belonged to the world would love its own. But because you do not belong to the world, and I have chosen you out of the world hates you. We're caught in the scriptures between two or perhaps three perceptions of this world we live in. On the one hand, it is created by God. It is good. It is seen by God to be good. At the other extreme, it is seen by Christ to be alien to God. It is under the power of the prince of darkness, the prince of this world. It is full of evil deviations from the will of God. So, and between those poles, we in our own experience know that to be human, to live in this world, is in some ways to live a life in which God is sort of opaque. We don't automatically recognize the presence of God in every beautiful happening that surrounds us, or in every relationship that we live through. The presence of God is somehow very opaque. Why? Well, I just indicate two sort of reasons, both from the scriptures and both from the book of Genesis. The account of creation gives us, believing Christians, the first intimation of the life of the Trinity. When God made man and woman in his own image, and when he created multiplicity, separation in his own image, he was kind of implying that at the level of infinity, there is an infinite distance between God and God, as well as an infinite closeness between God and God, and that God looks at God as one looks at the other, and that this implies an infinite movement of love and response, and that God wants to celebrate this in the dimension of time and space by creating the possibility of love. And the only way you can create the possibility of love is by having the phenomenon of what we call the other. Unless you can look into the eyes of the other and be looked at, there is no possibility of loving. And God has created a world in which love is possible. But he's also created one in which the rejection of love is possible, for you can't have one without the other. And so in the Garden of Eden, the whole concept of the garden implies the fruit, and it implies the possibility of disobedience. It implies the loss of the garden, a separation which is deeper and darker than the initial separation of creation itself, deeper and darker, and implies the need for a journey back to the garden. And the whole of the Old Testament and the New Testament are a story of the journey back, and it's a journey of loving, and it's a journey in which the horizontal beam, the horizontal weight of this world is, by its inner dynamic, constantly dragged downwards, but by its relation with the upright, constantly held upwards and constantly pointing towards the existence of what we call the sacramental dimension. And again, that's one of the things I will want to be talking about. Your presence here this week is an expression of sacrament. It's an expression of the fact that you want to bring your children, your prayers, your worries, your joys, your desire to celebrate, you want to bring it here so that it can be held for a time in the very clear upright which the Abbey represents, which this place represents. I want to leave you this morning with the image of the horizontal and the upright and the joint. And I hope that what we can talk about, celebrate, laugh about during the week will deepen our sense of being the joint, so that when we all go back to living and carrying the weight of the horizontal, we will have a stronger and deeper sense that it's being held at the joint. Not only as a community, but also individually. That is the Christian vocation, to be living at the heart of God's world, deeply committed to the beauties, the glories of human life, but always wanting to make space in them for the presence of the sustaining upright. If I go on any longer, I shall start repeating myself, if I haven't already done so quite considerably. So I'll stop there, if I may. All right.